Hey everybody, welcome to another episode of the podcast. I'm your host, Brian Keane, online fitness coach, nutritionist, and three-time best-selling author, normally here helping you by deconstructing expert guests on all things health, fitness, and mindset. But today's episode is a solo Q&A. So last week, I did a solo Q&A. This week, I'm following it up with another solo Q&A. Based on the feedback, I did put up a poll on my Instagram a while back on what were some of your favorite types of episodes, and it was quite split between solo episodes, Q&As, and guests. But I did get quite a few DMs from people who asked about doing a little bit more solo Q&As where I'm answering questions myself and kind of giving my own expertise on areas that I think I can help with. So in listening to that, here is a back-to-back podcast for a Q&A. So last week, we focused heavily on the fitness side of things, nutrition side of things. This week's episode is going to take a similar approach, but we are going to go into the realm of self-care, hitting multiple goals, some more applicable tools potentially to help you with everyday life as opposed to just fitness and nutrition. So without further ado, let's jump into today's podcast. Question one, how do I stop binge eating at nighttime when I'm stressed? There's a few potential angles that I could come at from this with a question like this. And probably the first thing is, if binge eating is something you struggle with, you probably need to identify where you fall on the binge eating spectrum. And what I mean by that is if you are on that kind of 1 to 5 on the spectrum, meaning that you are binge eating and you've got poor behavioral patterns around food, i.e. you've got a unsupportive coping mechanism when stressed where you turn to food, versus this is impending or impinging and having a very negative impact on my overall quality of life, i.e. that 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 scale, you probably need professional help, meaning that you go to a specialist or therapist, somebody who specializes in supporting binge eating that can help you get to the root of where it's coming from and potentially put tools and strategies in place around that. So I just want to preface that depending on where you fall, somebody like me who's a certified nutritionist and who expertly or it works with people in this area and has some general expertise when it comes to unsupportive coping mechanisms with food, as someone who's worked with people for the past 10 years, I might be able to help you here. But if you fall on that opposite end of the spectrum, I'd recommend seeking professional help because I think that will actually yield better progress for you. With that in mind, binge eating at nighttime when stressed is very common. I think when you think of coping mechanisms, it's very useful to see that we normally have a routine that we will fall into when something works as a trigger, meaning that stress in this context can be the trigger. And the coping mechanism, from what you've said, is going to be food. Now, we all have different coping mechanisms. Some will have sex, some will use porn, some will have food, some will have alcohol, drugs. There's unlimited amount of potential coping mechanisms out there. Some of them are more supportive than others. For example, I would argue that fitness for some people can be a very supportive coping mechanism to deal with stress. So personally, when I feel quite stressed or overwhelmed from generally in my case, individual of one here, in terms of story and anecdote, it's when I've been overwhelmed and I've said yes to too many things. I generally don't turn to food. I don't stress eat. I boredom eat. So one of my triggers is if I'm bored, I can turn to food to alleviate that boredom. But I don't stress eat. But I do stress train and I do stress work out, which can be really useful to a point. So I can go and feel this chronic stress from overwhelm and feeling really crap and just, you know, things getting on top of me. And I can go and do a really good workout. And then I feel completely de-stressed. That acute stressor can work for chronic stress. However, in the past, when I've made very poor life choices with my work, particularly when I was working full-time as a teacher, some of the relationships I was in, some of the people I was surrounding myself with in my inner circle at the time, I would have to use training multiple times a day to try and alleviate that stress, which actually caused its own problem. Too much stress, too much cortisol, and it became this negative feedback loop. And food can become the same version of this, where you have something that's triggered you to become and feel that stress state. And now food is the thing that's going to temporarily alleviate that feeling of discomfort. And I would consider looking at two potential angles here. One is a prevention being better than cure, and the other is what do you do when you start to feel that that's an alternative coping mechanism that's more supportive to you than turning to food. So we'll start with the prevention being better than cure. With stress, and I talk about this in quite a lot of detail, it's got its own full chapter in my last book, The Keen Edge, Mastering the Mindset for Real Lasting Fat Loss. Stress management techniques. I think sleep and stress are two of the most underutilized tools that people can sometimes disregard with a weight or a fat loss goal. We tend to, and I've done this in the past myself, where we'll go to nutrition and we'll go to training first and foremost. And, you know, to man with a hammer, the whole world looks like a nail. It's so easy to put that lens of, well, fix your nutrition, fix your training, and your weight will come down or your fat loss will come down. And we can ignore other things that yield a very positive return if we can prioritize them, i.e. our stress management techniques and our sleep quality at nighttime. So stress being something that you can potentially prevent. And I would look at your eating regimen during the day. So things from my experience of working with people that can be a real issue for stress is normally diet or food consumption during the day. So a lot of highly processed foods or too much sugar or too many stimulated drinks. So all of these things can potentially lead you to feeling a little bit more stressed at night, just from a lack of nutrients, too many stimulants, an overactive central nervous system from those stimulants, etc. So look at your food choices throughout the day, meaning that you're eating good quality nutrient dense food throughout the day and you're not having a stress response at nighttime from low nutrient food or excess and too many stimulants. That's one area. Another area is your training and your meditation protocol. So working out, moving your body, or just a meditation protocol or a journaling protocol, something that works as prevention to that stress state at nighttime. So if you know that, well, it's every night at 7 p.m. or 8 p.m. or 9 p.m., I feel this way, what are the things you can do during the day that can potentially work as short-term stress relievers that mean it won't compound into this big, massive blowout at nighttime? And that might be, you know, moving throughout the day. It might be getting to the gym for a short workout, or just, you know, when I say short, I mean 45 minutes, 50 minutes in terms of an intense workout, but you're not spending 3-4 hours in the gym. Obviously, it's goal dependent here, but in terms of stress release, you want to keep it as a minimum effective dose, and maybe a meditation protocol. So using something like the Calm app or Headspace, or journaling into your phone, or journaling into a notepad, or doing a gratitude journal, something I speak about in my second book, Rewire Your Mindset, but rewiring your mindset for gratitude so that you feel less stressed throughout the day. So there are a few things you can consider. I would then obviously look at your sleep quality. This plays a massive role in your, not only your physiological response the next day in terms of optimizing hormones, because certain hormones will become downregulated when you have poor quality sleep. Ghrelin, leptin, just to name two, your hunger and satiation hormone, but cortisol can be elevated, stress hormone can be so high or elevated to the point where it's too high, and you have all of these negative physiological responses from a poor night's sleep. And sometimes if we're not focusing on sleep quality and there's these other stressors, it's not that the stress was the problem, it was your inability to cope with the stress. And that can be down to not having a good quality sleep. Some people will turn to supplementation for this as well, certain adaptogens. Maca root comes to mind straight away, but there's several others where it can help your body deal with stress and deal with cortisol. That's what an adaptogen effectively is. But with sleep, you can have a higher level or a higher perceived level of being able to deal with stressful situations because you've had a high quality night's sleep. So I wouldn't underutilize that. So they're all the prevention better than cure. To come at it then from the, okay, I'm actually feeling stress standpoint, you're looking at potentially substituting in an alternative coping mechanism for that moment in time, particularly to help you get over the short term. So there's a very useful book from Charles Duhigg, The Power of Habit. I think James Clear's Atomic Habits also talks about this. I also speak about this in my books, all three of them actually, because of The Power of Habit. And that is understanding that cue routine reward of habit formation. So a cue is normally the trigger. So what's happened in that moment to affect your routine. So, you know, what routine do you follow after this point? And then you go into the reward. So a very basic example of this is the one from The Fitness Mindset, my first book. When I used to work as a primary school teacher, I would have a routine or a queue where I would come in every day after school and I would go to the cupboard in my kitchen in London. I would pull out a big massive Milka Dime bar and I would sit down and I would watch game shows. So I had my queue. I had my routine of coming home. I had my queue, which was following that, going to the cupboard, taking out the chocolate. And then the reward was kind of the dopamine hit or the serotonin hit from the chocolate. And I tried to break that habit. And I did break that habit very successfully, where instead of going into the kitchen, I pre-packed a gym bag before I left for work. I would come home from school around 4:15, 4:30 p.m. I would throw down my school bag. I would pick up my gym bag and I would go straight to the gym. So I changed that cue, changed that routine, and then got the reward from and workout and exercising instead. With binge eating at nighttime, it might be a case of breaking up and changing either the cue or changing the routine so that you can have a new outcome from what's happening instead of following that routine of going into food and then potentially going into, you know, a mild food coma, which can happen with binge eating at nighttime from my experience. And what that might look like is something as simple as when you feel that stress, you go for a walk and you get out into nature and you get outside. Or, you know, if you're in Ireland or the UK and you can't do that because of weather conditions, you know, you go and do an 8-minute workout somewhere. You move your body. This is where I'm a big fan of things like Tabata. So something like a squats or mountain climbers where you do 20 seconds on, 10 seconds off, 8 rounds, and that's 4 minutes. You could do 2 rounds of that for 8 minutes. And what you'll find is it breaks up that routine of what you've been doing. Or you can read a book, something that works as a de-stressor. Or you go to another room and you meditate. Or you pull out your phone and you start doing gratitude journaling into an app. There's potentially a million different ways that you could do this. And from my experience, you probably need both tools in your arsenal. I speak about that in The Keen Edge about stress management. It's about the prevention being better than cure. But also when you've actually got to the point where, do you know what, I've gone too far, I'm feeling stressed, what do I do now? There are some potential examples of things that might be able to help you. Question two, Brian, can you give me some high protein breakfast ideas? I'll keep this one quite short and kind of list off a few potential things that you can use here. And I think just to underline this, I think with a body composition goal, either a weight loss, fat loss, toning up, building muscle, or even performance if you're an athlete, one really useful tool that you can anchor your day with is having a high quality breakfast that includes a protein source. Now, depending on your protocol, obviously if you're following an intermittent fasting protocol, you're still having a breakfast, you know, you're breaking your fast at some point, it's just going to be later in the day. But I think having protein in that meal with those goals that I've mentioned can be really useful. Now, some that come to mind are some that I have in my program. I'm literally going to pull it right up here in front of me in my BKF online program. I also have similar ones with my GA players in my GA Lean Body program. But with breakfast, it's just about finding something that you enjoy and that kind of fits into your lifestyle and routine. I think breakfast, more so than any other meal, is one that needs to suit your schedule. So if you're someone who likes to sit down and de-stress in the morning and have a meal and just savor that meal, then you're going to have a different meal option or meal choice to somebody who's high, busy individual, either has to be out the door in the morning to get to the office or has to prepare kids for school and then get to work or prepare kids for school and get out the door. You're going to have different requirements, meaning that what you prep and what you use for breakfast in the morning will be kind of tailored to you. Some of the ones I like in my breakfast, to rhyme them off in order here, some of you have been through my program, so you've already seen these. The vegan protein muffins, which is a recipe in my program. The Flexi Bowl. Overnight oats, which is a big fan favorite for people I've worked with in my programs who are busy, where you can pre-prep it, 2 or 3 minute job with your overnight oats the night before, and then you just grab it and it's on the go in the morning. I've got sweet potato protein pancakes in there. You can make protein pancakes with lots of different options. Oat protein pancakes is in there as well. Apple and cinnamon protein pancakes, homemade muesli, coconut nutty granola, healthy egg muffin cups, chicken sweet potato hash browns with poached eggs, breakfast omelette roll-ups. Like, there's unlimited options that you could take. There's also smoothie options in there. So I've got my sunrise banana smoothie, my berry breakfast shake, chocolate morning smoothie, to name a few. And as I said, with recipes and food choices in the morning, it's largely personal preference based on what you like and what you enjoy, mixed in with what suits your schedule. And, you know, you can't go too wrong with, you know, a protein powder mixed in with some food for protein pancakes or a protein smoothie. Eggs, a phenomenal food choice in the morning, assuming you have no allergy to it or intolerance to eggs. Very high protein, egg whites in particular. I'm a fan of yolks as well, but it's more for the fat that's in the yolks. But there's lots of different options you could take here, whether you're vegan, whether you're plant-based, whether you're vegetarian, or whether you eat all foods on, you know, a paleolithic or normal menu. There's lots of options that you could take there, and there's just a few. Question three, how do you do self-care, Brian? I think it's important to establish here that self-care is very subjective, meaning that what self-care for one person probably isn't for another person. And the most important thing to determine is, what does self-care mean to you? Now, I will give you my definition of it and what I do, but I think you need to establish your own version of what this means. In my second book, Rewire Your Mindset, and I talk about this at my mindset seminar as well, that success is so subjective. So in the four quadrants, this is what I use for seminars, and in the book, Health, Wealth, Love, and Fulfillment, your subjective version of success is going to be very personal to you. So for example, what health means to me is very different to a me of 5 years ago or a me of 10 years ago, which is very different to somebody that I'll ask down the street. For me, health is waking up feeling energized in the morning. It's having enough energy and vitality through the day so that I'm present with loved ones, so I'm able to have optimal workouts, so that I can put out good work into the world and be able to concentrate and do that. So that's what kind of health means to me. And in more recent years, mental health has taken a big forefront or a big hold on that. That, you know, what do I need to do that reduces my anxiety levels? So, you know, I regularly do digital detoxes, where I'll come off my phone and I won't use my phone, where I'm completely outside contact to everybody in the world who isn't my inner circle. And they're all things that I consider self-care for me. But I have kind of pillars of this. I've got my health and wellness as my self-care, so my working out regularly, my food intake, so my nutrient choices of food. I eat a probably 80 to 90% nutrient dense food. I don't count calories. I don't count macros. I don't do any of that. I follow more of a kind of clean eating approach. Now, I should put an asterisk here. My goal isn't and hasn't been body composition in at least several years, at least 5 years, if not longer. Most of my goals now are energy levels, feeling high levels of vitality through the day, recovering from workouts, fueling for workouts. They're my primary goals. So I don't count macros and calories. Now, when I had a body composition goal, when I was competing as a fitness model, when I was doing bodybuilding shows, when I was in college, when I was in working as a primary school teacher, where how I looked had quite a high level of value for me, I tracked my calories and I tracked my macros because that's what I wanted to do. And the process that I took reverse engineered the end goal. So I just wanted to clarify that now. But for me at the minute, it's not something. My food is what I call in the first book, The Fitness Mindset, Making the Right Automatic Food Choice. I just know now, from having eaten this way for, you know, 20 plus years, having worked with people for 10 plus years, I know what foods work for my body. I keep it mostly nutrient dense. I have, you know, a lot of complex carbohydrates for fueling workouts. So I have clean cut meals as of now, at the time of recording, are kind of a big chunk of my food intake. So I have my brown basmati rice in there as a food choice. I have my porridge and oats that I take post-workout. And then I'll cycle between other things throughout the day if I feel I need a bump or an increase. So I'll have rice cakes with some tuna, or I'll have other foods that work quite well for my body. I focus on high quality meats. Or let me rephrase, high quality proteins. I actually haven't eaten meat in months. High quality proteins. So I eat a lot of fish, salmon, tuna, cod, etc. Lots of plants, which is a big chunk of my diet. So I have a lot of asparagus in those meals with clean cut meals. I have bowls of salad, bowls of vegetables throughout the day with almond butter or nut butters. And sometimes I'll add in a protein source in on top of it. But that's kind of the crux of my nutrition self-care. And that for me, which will come back to something I'm going to talk about next about succeeding at multiple goals, is the foundation pillar of my self-care. Because if I look after my nutrition, everything else feels better for me, meaning that my workouts are better, so I'm moving a lot throughout the day. That movement and working out regularly that's unfueled from stimulants means I sleep better. And that sleep better allows me to make better food choices the next day because of that balance in hormonal function from having high quality sleep. And all of those things tend to cycle and compound positively on top of each other. I also have mental health self-care that I've spoken about. Something I struggled with for a large portion of my 20s and early 30s to a degree, I'm 34 now, 35 at the end of this year, was my anxiety, where I was just that catch 22 of being a type A personality, that you're constantly thinking and overthinking and your brain is always on the go, which is brilliant from an external success standpoint. It means that I generally don't struggle to get things done. If I have a book deadline, I get the deadline done and I get the book written in that time. If I have podcasts to record, I'll record those podcasts or I'll prepare for those interviews. That type A personality is very useful for actually going out and getting stuff done. I don't miss workouts. I don't miss meals. I don't do any of those things because my high anxiety state means that I know what's coming up next. But the trade-off for that is overthinking, constantly in your head, struggling to just switch your brain off. And over the last 2 or 3 years, this is something that I've had to include in my self-care regimen in order to kind of feel better about my life quality overall. So I generally, as I mentioned, have regular digital detoxes where I don't have my phone anywhere near me. I have windows of creative time that I try and create work. So this is a window of the moment in that time where I'm creating this podcast. I'll do some work after this and then I'll have a disconnect period throughout the day in the middle of the day where it's just me and, you know, a loved one or somebody that I care about, normally with a person, that just allows me to disconnect from all things Brian Keane fitness, all things business related. And then I can reconnect with that in the evening and go back and do some more high quality work. So for me, that is my version of self-care. It pillars and foundations with that nutrition that I mentioned that falls into training on top of it, which falls into sleep, and they all feed into one another. And then I've got the mental health element on the other side. I also do regular recovery protocols where I'll take time to myself. I do a lot of work in the sauna. I'll do some work in the ice, which all work really well for me for bringing me back into my body. I tend to struggle still to this day with traditional meditation using an app or otherwise, but I find that moving my body or putting my body into an extreme such as the heat or cold with a sauna or an ice bath tends to bring me back into my body and it switches my brain off. So they're protocols I use. They're not going to work for everybody, but they're what I consider self-care techniques. But I can't emphasize enough that this is so subjective to you, to me, to each person that you ask. And the old phrase of one man's meat is another man's poison, or one woman's meat is another woman's poison, comes to mind here. What I do might not be beneficial for you, such as the extreme cold and the extreme heat that I mentioned. I think probably the nutrition, training, moving and sleep, that nourishing your body, moving your body, recovering your body is a good approach for the majority of people to take. But determine where and what elements of your life need the most level of self-care. Put the focus and attention on that. As always, take probably a scientific approach. Change one thing at a time. See if it yields a benefit. If it does, keep it and then move on to the next thing. If it doesn't, remove it and then move on to the next thing until you find the protocol that works best for you. Question 4. Is it possible to succeed at more than one goal at a time? Example, weight loss, job, studying, mindset, etc. This was a great question. This came in through my Instagram Q&A. And I did do an expansion in that, but I definitely wanted to keep it and hold it for a podcast episode. One, because it's not something I previously explored. But two, it's something that is becoming an idea within the writing of what will be my next book. At the minute, it's a book on mental resilience, but it's learning to let go, dealing with anxiety through building mental resilience. And something I thought about a lot recently is what I mentioned earlier about how some goals layer on top of one another. And when I think about succeeding at one or more goal, I tend to look at, well, what one goal will yield the most benefit for all my multiple goals? And for me, it always comes back to nutrition and sleep. They're the two, and training is in there as well, but I'll get on to that. Nutrition and sleep for me are the two things that tend to yield the most positive benefit in all facets and areas of my life. Meaning that if I'm eating well and if I'm sleeping well, I find other things in life considerably easier. Meaning that when I'm working or I have a chapter to write of a book or I have a podcast to record or I'm coaching on a program or I'm creating a course, all things that kind of fall into what would be considered areas of work for my life, I feel those things are a lot easier when I'm rested well and when I'm fueled and have all the nutrients my body needs. It also leads to me having very positive relationships, romantic with my partner, fatherly with my daughter, with my mom, with my dad, with my sister, with my closest friends, because I tend to be quite present when I'm with them, or at least I have the aspiration of being quite present when I'm with them, because I've either learned to get my mind where it needs to be at that point in time, because you'll have certain skill sets that will cross over into other areas of your life. So for example, when I'm writing a book or when I'm recording a podcast, and this is going to sound very left field, but might be useful for you based on what you do in your life and career and job. One of the things you have to do for me in order to have a good podcast, either a solo episode or with an interview in particular, is I have to be fully present in that moment in order to give everything that I think I can to be in a point of service for those listening. But that skill set of being present in that moment can cross over, and you can take that skill that you have in this domain, in this area over here, and apply it in your relationship with your boyfriend, girlfriend, husband, wife, or your daughter or your son, or your mother or your father, or your best friends. You can take that skill of presentness and bring it into another area of your life. So I find that there's a little bit of a cross skill set that succeeding in one area can benefit other areas as well. So I found that nutrition and sleep tends to be the bottom of that. And any other area that I have, whether it's job related or work related, whether it's family related or relationship related, or whether it's anything else, once I'm feeling good, I'm feeling rested, and I'm feeling that my body has all the nutrients it needs, everything else feels easier. So I think some goals layer on top of one another, so they actually benefit one another. On the contrary, though, there are certain goals that won't feed into one another. There's a term in economics that I've spoken about on previous podcasts called opportunity cost, that in economics, if you spend €1, £1, or $1 on a can of Coke, you can't spend that same euro, pound, or dollar on a bottle of water. There's an opportunity cost. That money is gone. And there's an opportunity cost of time when you're trying to hit a specific goal. And something that I'll speak about at mindset seminars, I've spoken about it in books, is you can have anything you want, you just can't have everything you want. Meaning that if you are tunnel vision and focused towards a specific goal, and you set yourself up for an environment and have an environment where you allow good things to happen, I think luck is the prepared mind meeting opportunity, and you do that, you'll be able to hit 9 times out of 10, probably 90 times, 9 out of 100 times, you'll be able to hit your end goal, whatever that is, once you realign the expectations accordingly based on your starting point, genetics, your lifestyle, all of these things that have played a role in this. Like, for example, it doesn't matter how much I try, I'm not going to be an NBA superstar. I'm 5'8", little T-Rex arms, built like a hobbit. I'm not ever going to be in the NBA. So I would need to align my expectations accordingly. But for the majority of goals I set for myself that are realistic for me and within that spectrum of where I can achieve, if I focus hard enough on them, I tend to be able to hit them, as can most people. And with that, you also have to realize that doing that across several facets of your life can be hard, because what you focus on is what expands, and where you put the most time and energy, you know, there's an old, I think it's a sage philosophy of, you know, where attention goes, energy flows. And that's brilliant for a specific goal. But when you try and split that time, energy, or focus, it can dilute it. And that's where you have to get clear on what is it you should be saying yes to and what is it you should be saying no to. Something I talk about at seminars and I speak about in Rewire Your Mindset, the book, is yes becomes crystal clear when you know what you should be saying no to. And that goes for the people you hang around with. That goes for the invitations that you get to events. That goes for anything. That when you learn that I need to be saying no to this, there's an opportunity cost for every time I say yes. So if I say yes to meeting this person for coffee who I don't really like, it's an opportunity that I now have to say potentially no to somebody who I do really want to go out and have coffee with. And when you start to look at things from that area, it can be a little bit of an eye-opener to where you're spending your time, where you're spending your energy, where you're spending your focus. And I think when it comes to hitting goals, Some will layer on top of each other, like I said. Some will come at the cost of one another, such as running a marathon and trying to build muscle. It's not that you can't do both goals or try and achieve both goals. It's just that those two goals can be on opposite ends of the spectrum. So if you're trying to, you know, run 50 or 100 miles a week to optimally prepare for a marathon, and you have a goal of building muscle alongside that, you have to really look at your nutrition to keep your calorie intake up, hitting your minimum protein requirements, etc. So those two goals, although 100% achievable, something I've covered on previous podcasts, it just becomes harder because of where they fall on opposite ends of the spectrum. So keeping that in mind is also useful when it comes to the goals. So I would determine on, well, what are your goals? In whatever way you want to break up your life, I have a preference towards the four quadrants: health, wealth, love, and fulfillment. But you can have your own versions of this and determine what success looks like for you. And then ask the question, well, which one of these potential goals that I have for myself, i.e., you know, is it weight loss where you want to lose weight or you want to lose body fat? Will that have a positive impact in the other areas of your life? So, you know, if you think it'll make you feel more confident, that could have a positive impact in your job, in your career. If you think that the nutrient-dense foods will improve your concentration, that could help with your studying. And if you start to feel good about yourself and setting those small goals that allow you to hit those daily, weekly, monthly targets in weight loss, if that strengthens your mindset by building up that resilience, by conditioning yourself to do the things you have to do regardless of how you feel, then that one goal can potentially yield positive benefits in other several goals that you have for yourself. So determine which ones can yield the most benefit, determine firstly what they are, and then decide on, well, this is actually the one that I want. And as I said, I am a firm believer, and I think I'll go to my grave believing, that you can have anything you want in life, you just can't have everything you want in life. And once you're clear on what's important to you, what you should be saying yes to, what you should be saying no to, all of that becomes a lot easier over time. Question five. I have 1 hour free every day. Do I go walking or do some form of resistance training? My goal is maintenance. Okay, so if it's maintenance of a weight loss or fat loss goal, probably either or could potentially work, assuming that your nutrition is dialed in and is in accordance with the maintenance you're looking to sustain. If your goal is muscle and maintaining that muscle, then you're going to have to keep the resistance training. With muscle, muscle is very metabolically useful for people when it comes to, say, body composition goals, because the more lean muscle tissue you have, and I'm not saying big bulky muscle, like muscle is very lean by nature. Some people have a misconception that muscle is big and bulky. It's not. Muscle is very lean. It's muscle plus fat is big and bulky. But it's very metabolically useful, meaning that the more lean muscle tissue you have, the higher your metabolic rate, so you'll burn more calories while you're resting. But it's quite, from an evolutionary standpoint, quite useless for people to have a lot of muscle, meaning that in hunter-gatherer times, having loads of muscle on your body wasn't a good survival strategy for the majority of people. That's why when it costs so much energy and effort to build and maintain muscle with nutrition, with training, etc., but it loses, and you can lose it very quickly, that's down to, you know, evolution of your biology and survival over the past 10,000 years. And the adage that normally gets applied to this is, if you don't use it, you lose it. And that's true with training and with resistance. And even the most genetically gifted individuals with a predetermined mesomorph frame, where they pack on muscle really easily, if you put them in a bed for 6 months, all their muscle will atrophy and they'll lose the majority of that muscle. And that's why I think knowing you on your front end what your goal is will determine what you do here. So if you just have a weight loss maintenance where you're like, you know what, I've lost weight, I've lost body fat, I'm quite happy where I'm at, and I quite enjoy walking, being active, moving, and assuming you dial your nutrition with that, that's probably going to be more than enough to maintain your current weight. However, resistance training provides so many more benefits than just walking alone that it's probably worth considering mixing and matching both. And resistance training, on top of the metabolic benefit that I mentioned earlier, it can help with that fat loss goal and that muscle maintenance goal, because you burn more calories while you're resting. Something I call in books that, you know, you burn fat while you watch TV. That's what happens with resistance training. That doesn't necessarily happen with cardiovascular activity, particularly low intensity cardio like walking. So you might want to keep it for that. Strength, if you have a longevity goal, you know, a lot of people, their bodies break down, their bones break down as they age, can be offset, and you can offset a lot of this. Dr. David Sinclair talked about this when he was on the podcast, the author of Lifespan, that resistance training and strength training can help with that longevity for those who have aspirations to be moving when they're 80 and moving when they're 90 and not falling down and breaking a hip or falling down and, you know, breaking a body part or breaking a bone that won't or will struggle to repair because of age. They are all things that you can start to do now that will help with that. As with most things, when I think of the cardio versus resistance training program in terms of pros and cons, both have benefits and both have potential cons. And there's an opportunity cost too that I talked about earlier, that every time you spend walking is time you're not resistance training. And every time you're resistance training is not time walking or doing a low interval, low intensity, steady state cardio. And I think with most things, the goal is dependent and important here, but I'd probably mix and match both to get the best of both worlds. It doesn't have to be an all or nothing. If you've got an hour free every day, you don't have to walk every day. And if you have an hour free every day, you don't have to do resistance training every day. You can do a combination of both, and that way you'll probably get both benefits and it won't come at any major extra cost because you already have that hour free every day. 6, what's the optimal macro split and calorie surplus when training to build muscle? This is a little bit of a how long is a piece of string question, but I will break it down and give a little bit of context. So for muscle building, there's a few things you need to do. And I've talked on this and touched on this in last week's episode in the solo Q&A as well, that building muscle is a lot more complex than losing body fat. But losing body fat is a very straightforward process. Now, it's not easy. You have to apply it. Behavioral issues around food, lifestyle situations, hormonal imbalances, all these things can impact it. But in terms of the process, it's very straightforward. It's very linear. You get into a deficit, you allow your body to tap into stored fat for fuel, and you do that consistently over time. Building muscle is more complex than that. Building muscle requires you to create enough resistance on the muscle to tear those fibers down, and then you need to repair them with enough amino acids from protein sources that you're consuming, potentially enough calories to support that growth, and then recovering optimally with your sleep generally for the most part. So it's not as straightforward as just get into a calorie deficit, be consistent with that, which for 99 of 100 people will elicit fat loss. Building muscle is more complex. There's also the genetic component that you need to consider with building muscle. Now, this is also applicable for fat loss. Some people will lose fat considerably faster, depending on genetic starting point, etc. But building muscle, this tends to be a lot more obvious for people. And if you have somebody that is, quote unquote, the language used is a hard gainer, somebody who struggles to put on size, you will have to adjust your calorie intake and macro split and put hyper awareness on those two things in order to find what works best for you. Whereas if you have another individual who looks at a weight and grows, you know, for the lack of a better figurative expression, they're not going to have to worry about this as much. And I can use myself as an example here. So when I was in secondary school, when I was in college, I put on muscle very easily. So it didn't really matter what I did. As long as I did resistance training, whether it was with my body weight or with weights, I put on size, I put on muscle. I've got quite a decent genetic starting point frame for building muscle. Growing up on a farm, mixed with father, grandfather genetics, I've got a good frame for building muscle. And as a result of that, I didn't have to worry about calories and macros all that much until I started competing in my mid-20s, because I was always able to put on muscle and I was always able to stay relatively lean, although not ultra lean, because it just wasn't hard. Whereas I had friends, one of my housemates who I lived with in college and for a year after college, he was a hard gainer and he had to calculate every calorie and every macro, and he would spend months meticulously dialing in these macronutrients throughout the day. And then if he took a break for 2 weeks, he would lose all his muscle. That was just his genetic frame. And depending on where you fall, either on that side of the spectrum where you struggle to put on size, or my side where you actually find it quite easy, or even in between, you're going to have to put more awareness and focus on your macro split and calorie surplus depending on that, because somebody who puts on muscle easily is just going to grow regardless of what they do. And with optimal macro splits and calorie surpluses, that's just the macro picture, pardon the pun, in terms of how to look at this holistically. But the answer with optimal macro splits and calorie surplus is there is no one size. If there was a one size optimal macro split, everybody would follow that and everybody would be able to build muscle quite easily. The one thing you do need to do with your macros is ensure you are hitting your daily minimum protein requirements. That's the only thing you have to do. Carbohydrate intake and fat intake will be dependent on a whole host of other factors that I'll get onto, but you have to hit your protein requirements. If you are under eating protein or not consuming high quality bioavailable protein sources, you're not going to be able to build muscle. The analogy I use in books, it's like trying to build a house without any blocks or any bricks. That if you don't have the materials, you can't build the body. If you don't have the bricks and blocks, you can't build the house. And amino acids and protein fall into that category. After that, then, there's a few things to consider. Whether you go with fat or carbohydrate as your predominant fuel source, or you do a combination of both, you have to experiment with that. Some people work better off carbohydrate. Other people work better off fat. So something I've spoken about on previous podcasts, probably a couple of years ago now, because I haven't touched on this question in quite a while, is if I use myself as an example, and I tend to use Paul Dermody, who's been on this podcast several times, as the other example, because we are on opposite ends of the macro spectrum when it comes to fat and carbohydrate, meaning that I can drop my carbohydrates to zero, and I have regularly in the past, particularly when I used to compete and do body composition, and I can drop my carbs to zero and feel fine, or 30 grams a day and feel perfect. No problem. As long as my fats don't drop, I feel pretty good. And if anything, I feel amazing on that plan. I don't feel bloated. I don't feel sluggish. My workouts are good. I feel pretty high quality of life day to day. Where Paul is the complete opposite. As soon as he drops his carbohydrates below 100 grams per day, he hates his life and he can't think, he can't work out well. And he's the opposite with his fats. Whereas if you drop my fats, I become a brain dead zombie. I can't think. I literally can't do simple tasks when my fats drop too low. And Paul is the opposite. So you also have to establish, no more than the genetic example I gave earlier, where do you fall on that carb and fat spectrum? Now you can do things that test this, but probably the best and easy to use example is, what do you feel better on? Ross Edgley was on the podcast a couple of years ago and we had this discussion and he spoke about what would you prefer for breakfast? He goes, where does your mouth salivate and what does your body crave when you think, you know, 10 egg yolks, you know, and 15 egg whites on a massive breakfast where you're just loaded up with fat and protein, or a big massive 100 and 150 gram bowl of porridge? What do you prefer? What sounds better to you? And generally, where you go to, assuming you like both of those foods, will be what you like with your fat or carbohydrate and what you run better off. I will always go for a high fat option versus a high carb option in most cases, assuming I'm not training for a specific race or following some form of carb cycling protocol for a secondary goal. If you're just asking kind of bread and butter day to day, what I like to do, that's for me. So you have to establish what works best for you there as well, because that's going to ultimately set you up for long-term success with muscle building, because both strategies work. Hitting your daily minimum protein requirements with high carbs in a calorie surplus will help for building muscle, assuming all other things are designed around muscle building, the right training program, recovery and sleep protocol, etc. The same as hitting your daily protein requirements and high fat with low carbohydrate will also yield positive results for muscle building, or a split combination where you do more of a 50-50 or 60-40 split on either of those macronutrients. So there's lots of things to consider there. Your calorie surplus then also is important to consider here, although less important in my experience than your macro split, although they all tie into one another. You can't have one without the other, meaning that once you basic macro splits are 4 grams for every kilocalorie, every gram of carbohydrate or protein you eat, there's 4 kilocalories. Every gram of fat you eat, there's 9 kilocalories. So you can't really do one without the other. But the old nutrition standpoint that normally helps people is calories being the bottom of the pyramid of prioritization for fat loss, and macros being the bottom of the pyramid of prioritization for muscle building, meaning that you have to pay more attention to your macro split with a muscle building goal. Whereas if you have a fat loss goal, calories become more important. Again, I'm simplifying a very complicated term. It's not to say that macros aren't important for fat loss, the same as it's not to say that calories aren't important for macro building, but are in terms of muscle building, but just to kind of make this a little bit more straightforward and easier to follow. So your calories, in terms of how much of a surplus you go into, will be dependent on that starting point genetically that I talked about. Somebody like me, who puts on muscle quite easily, can go into 100 calorie surplus and put on muscle. Whereas my friend that I lived with in college, Kevin, he really struggled and had to be at least 1,000 calories in a surplus to put on any size, because his metabolic rate was just so fast. His body just burned through calories like paper on a fire. So he had to be in a minimum of 1,000 calorie surplus every day just to grow. So determine where you fall on that spectrum and then course correct as you go. Thankfully, you'll know, because if you're tracking your measurements, if you're tracking with photos, if you're tracking with other subjective, how do you feel, how do you look in terms of clothing size, etc., if you're moving in the direction of putting on more size, then you can keep doing what you're doing. If you're not, you've got feedback that it's not working. As I said, muscle building is a slightly more complicated process than losing body fat, but assuming that you're hitting your daily protein requirements, you're following a strength or resistance program regimen, ideally around hypertrophy, where, you know, 8 to 10 reps, 3 to 4 sets, 60 to 90 second rests based around compound lifts, etc. Probably some form of traditional bodybuilding split could be useful here, a push-pull leg split. Something along those lines can all help when it comes to building muscle. And then you look at your macro split. How do you want to do it with your fats, with your carbohydrates, with a combination of both, and then consistency over time. And then course correct. If you're not getting the results you want, you may need to change things up further, either yourself or with a professional, but both options can potentially work. It's just about finding what works best for you. Question 7, who is the best person to see to start a gut healing fixing process? So I'm not going to give a direct recommendation on a person here. What I will say is I've done some podcasts with gut health experts that I would listen to, and based on who connects the most with you or who you think can serve you the most, I would then potentially reach out to them to either work with them directly or work with them in their program. The three that come to mind are more recently, and two have been on quite recently, the gut health doctor, Dr. Megan Rossi. So she's been on the podcast twice. I would probably listen to both episodes. Dietitian Orla Walsh also has been on the podcast twice, very recently as well, where we talked a little bit about PCOS within that as well. And then Dr. James Lavelle is the third episode that I recorded about 2.5 years ago at this point, maybe 2 years ago. It was pre-COVID. Those three gut experts are and have covered lots of different areas that they specialize in. Dr. Megan Rossi, the gut health doctor, has a very wide approach to gut health, meaning that she's got so much content that she's created and conversations even we've had on this podcast that delve into everything from IBS and mental health to just nutrient absorption for body composition change. Whereas Orla Walsh has that IBS, that leaky gut, but also goes into female hormonal health with it. Dr. James Lavelle comes at it more from an endurance background. So endurance athletes whose microbiome gets destroyed from excessive training. So his angle is more working with the athlete. So depending on who or what your specific need is, one of those three people could potentially help you. Now, with gut health, it is dependent on how severe your issue is. If it is just day-to-day inconvenience, it's very similar to what I mentioned with the binge eating earlier, although I'm going to offer slightly different advice. If it's just day-to-day inconvenience, IBS, leaky gut, something that is hindering life quality but not excessively, then you can take your time with this. You can do your due diligence. You can listen to the podcast, maybe read the books and see and test things that work for you. If you have a severe gut issue where it is significantly impacting your quality of life, I would reach out to a professional sooner rather than later. Now, whether that's one of some the three that I've mentioned on the podcast or a medical professional, I would reach out. I think it's depending on the extremity of the situation, the timeline will be adjusted accordingly. So if it's just day-to-day inconvenience, you can take several weeks, several months experience, different people, listen to their podcast episodes, listen to their content, follow their content, and then see, are they the person who's going to work with you? This is the advice I generally offer with fat loss plans, weight loss plans, non-specific end date goals where you just want to lose body fat, you want to lose weight, but it's not for anything in particular. I'm like, take your time, figure out who's going to be a good coach for you, a good trainer. And I think the gut health also falls on that if it's just a minor inconvenience. But if you have an extreme issue, then you want to do this sooner rather than later. So I just wanted to kind of add that on as a bit of a caveat at the end. Question 8, any plans to come up north for a seminar? So north of Ireland, for those of you listening outside of Ireland. I don't know, and I'll keep this one short just because this one is very timely for now, because I have my Rewire Your Mindset seminar in Cork on October 29th. But if you're listening to this after, this is obviously completely irrelevant then. And I don't know, one of the things that with COVID and other speakers that I've had in the podcast have told me something very similar. The venues and events that were very cost effective pre-COVID are no longer that cost effective from my experience with them anyway. So the Clayton Hotel in Cork have been amazing to me and have given me a very good offer and a very good deal to come down and speak there, meaning that it makes sense to set up the entire event. I love my mindset seminars. They're one of my favorite things that I do. They're outside the realm of fitness. We talk a lot about, you know, dealing with negative people, setting up your goals that you have in other areas of your life, your health, wealth, love, and fulfillment. I absolutely love my seminars that I run. It's like the Rewire Your Mindset book on steroids. It's just another level up and a massive advancement from that. And the new one, I'm also tying in elements of what will be the new book out either next year, 2023 or 2024. But since COVID, most of the venues have doubled in price and some have even trebled in price, meaning that although I love doing it, it's not feasible with the setup costs and all the stuff that gets put into it in order to kind of run a what I try and have in my objective or subjective mind as a successful seminar. So I've no guarantee. I 100% know that Cork will be going ahead if you're listening to this before October 29th, 2022. After that, and all other venues, I'm not sure. I can't speak to that just because of a whole host of external factors. But yeah, as of now, no plans. But again, similar to the Clayton in Cork, I'm 100% open to potentially working with venues, good venues that can support the crowd who'd be at the event, as it's something that I love to do myself. Question 9, last question. Can you put on weight with antidepressants, worried it might affect my fitness? The short answer is here, yes, if it's a side effect of your medication. And the long answer is also yes, if it's a side effect of your medication, but with an asterisk. I was very hesitant to even touch on or answer this question. One, because I'm not a medical professional and I'm not a doctor and I don't play one on the internet. And also because I don't have all the context here of the individual. This is slightly different when I'm working with someone in my program where I can get all the context of your backstory. I know where someone's coming from. I might even have information on blood work and conversations you've had with your doctor, so I can be a little bit more specific on how to navigate this. But I think in terms of advice that will be unharmful here, and I'd be very mindful on asking any question about your own medical history to somebody who doesn't have all the context of your medical history, is communicating with your doctor would be a useful thing to do here. And antidepressants, by their nature, have a lot of side effects. And this isn't to say come off it. That is at best unhelpful advice, at worst harmful advice. But if you were having side effects from a medication such as weight gain or an inability to lose weight, which is very common with a lot of antidepressants, if you have this discussion with your doctor or your medical profession that you're concerned about these side effects, it could potentially open up that dialogue to find an alternative that would also have a mood boosting effect or antidepressant effect without the negative side effect of putting on weight or an inability to lose weight. So I would definitely have that conversation. And I think that when it comes to weight gain and antidepressants or any medication, dialogue with your professional, medical professional, is important here. And from my experience, and I've worked with lots of people over the years who have been on antidepressants coming to me into a program, And we've been able to lose weight with most of them. And I've been able to get body fat down with most of them, not all, because sometimes you're just working against a piece of or a medication you're taking. It's like trying to run a marathon with a 20 kilo vest. You can do it. It's just the timeline isn't long enough to do it. What would take 6 weeks with one person could take 6 months with somebody else. So we can have a little bit of a misalignment there with expectations because you're fighting against something else that's going on in your body. But I do think it's worth opening up that dialogue with your medical professional, with your doctor. And anytime you're concerned about these things, as I said, there's other things that you could potentially do that will support it. With antidepressants, there's, and we talked about this on the podcast with Johan Hari when he came off his antidepressants and his whole experience with his weight gain from that and then how he lost his weight after. So an interesting listen. I think a great podcast for anyone who struggles with mental health in general. Personally, particularly our first episode, Johan has been on the podcast twice. He's the author of Lost Connections, the hidden source of anxiety and depression in the world. And that could be useful as a, just an eye-opener in terms of potential other strategies that you could add in alongside your antidepressants that might be able to help you when it comes to your own mental health. As I said, I don't have all the context here and I'm very hesitant to even touch this question, but it is something that's been coming in quite frequently on my social media channels in particular. So I wanted to address it here, just that it is a common side effect. One of the areas of frustration, and this is where I can actually service and offer help, is the uncertainty element of, is that weight gain caused by the antidepressant? And normally when I tell somebody that it's a very common side effect, it's actually in the side effect if you look at the labels of most antidepressants, but a lot of us don't read the side effects on the labels because most of them aren't applicable, but it's very common. And once you know that, it kind of takes that weight off, that off, and pardon the pun, as in mental weight, emotional weight of, well, okay, it's the antidepressants that's doing this, and that's fine. And then you can make peace with it, or you can tighten up other areas, tighten up nutrition a little bit more. You might have to be a bit more restrictive or a bit tighter with that. But again, I'm talking purely nutritional and body composition standpoint. When you were on an antidepressant, from my experience, there's probably other areas of your life that are higher priority to focus on, you know, your sleep quality, your nutrient density in your food to feel better, your gut microbiome, a big area when it comes to mental health. I would look at that for sure. We talked about that a little bit in a previous episode with Dr. Megan Rossi, and several other episodes I've covered on gut health and mental health and the link between those two. But can you put on weight with an antidepressant? Yeah, 100%, particularly if it's a side effect. But talk to your medical profession, see if there's potential alternatives you could do if it's something you're concerned about, and hopefully that'll help too. So there you have it. That is all the questions for today. So 2 weeks of just me talking to the microphone. So hopefully you enjoyed it. As I said, nice little change of pace. I've got some really good interviews coming up with people, but just based on the requests of more solo episodes, more Q&As, I wanted to kind of just listen to that and hopefully it helps loads. So that's everything from today's episode. To get more details on anything I've spoken about in today's episode, the books I've mentioned, my books particularly, or my program, the BKF Online Program or GA Lean Body Program, just head over to briankeenfitness.com. They're all available on there. That's everything from me from today's episode. Catch you all next Monday.